Dawn, and just to give a little bit of history here of how this came about, is one day while I was talking on the phone with Jacqueline, I got a very clear message from Holy Spirit that said, you need to interview Jacqueline. And it just came, you know, out of left field, you know, as Holy Spirit always does, just kind of comes in. And I suggested it to Jacqueline and a couple of times. And we agreed. So this is, here we are. And so we'll see where all this goes. And I do have 9 questions prepared, but I will let the interview take its own life, as they say. So welcome. Thank you for being here, Jacqueline Eckert.
Ah, thank you, Jay McCormick.
Like I never met you. This is the first time I'm meeting you right here.
Cool.
So
hey, everybody.
This is Jacqueline, everybody, in case you didn't know. I guess the first question that came to me, and this is a question I guess that is good for all of us to ask, what has been, in your journey, Jacqueline, the greatest challenge that you've ever encountered, and how did you get through it? Like, what teachings or practices were most important to you? Take it away.
That's the first question. I should have made you give me these questions up front, Jay.
No.
Well, I assume that you're talking about in terms of events, but the answer that comes, so let me acknowledge that that's probably what you meant, but now let me answer from what comes to mind. And my greatest challenge to awakening has been the idea that I need to be somebody. sometimes that challenge is the idea that I need to be Regina or do the way that Regina does them or be as wise as Regina. And sometimes it's not quite so specific, you know, well, a vice president minister would do this or would have the resources to do that or, you know, would know the right thing to say or would have, you know, all of that stuff. And that that continues to be a challenge for me. I'm clear about that. I'm also clear that the greatest challenges are the opportunities for the greatest growth. And I think that I have I've seen that in this journey. But you know, a lot of times it feels like I'm being dragged, kicking and screaming.
I definitely meant it in terms of awakening, not like challenging in terms of an event. But I didn't put the word awakening in there. But yes, I definitely meant it in that way.
Cool. Good.
So, when you are prompted to have this be someone thing come up, what teachings or practices have you found that are useful to you in this, either, you know, currently or in the past?
Yeah. Inner Wisdom said to me on this very issue the other night, it's like, you know, you say you want to get rid of the self, you say you want to get rid of the self, and look at you just scrambling for self-will, you know? And this came through in regard to the idea of surrender. You know, and surrender is just so much more subtle than we imagine it to be. It's not just, gee, I'd rather, you know, have a chocolate bar than, you know, sit down and do the work that I'm being asked to do. But okay, I'll sit down and do the work that I'm being asked to do. It's surrender is just surrender is really the willingness to rethink everything. And I use that euphemistically, rethink. It's really the willingness to let go of my ideas about everything, about who I am, about how I show up, about who's right in this situation, about why I would even want to be right in this situation, about, you know, do you separate sentences into Do you separate teachings into short sentences so people can read them, you know, sentences all belong in a paragraph together? I mean, every single thing that I do, I have to give up the idea that I know how to do it. Yeah.
And to me, that sounds like a constant practice, like a mindfulness practice that you keep with you continuously. Is that, would that be an accurate description?
Well, I think it is. And of course, the consistent reminder is, you know, irritation. All right, I'll do it that way, right? Okay, I'll do it your way. But hearing that talk going on up here, that's what's so consistent. So this, my hand puppet, has been very, very helpful to me. You got yours there somewhere, I'm sure.
Not in reach. I'd have to leave my post to get my sock up.
Yeah, but just to realize that. Well, I guess it's that distance from those thoughts to be able to hear them and not think that that's me, not think that I have to think the way those thoughts are telling me to think. I think that step has been a critical one for me. Otherwise you just do as you're told. you do as you're told by these thoughts. But the separation from the thoughts, the ability to see that they're not me and they're not true, enables me to choose against those thoughts, to choose in a different way.
So it's a mindfulness practice of not only listening to the thoughts, but listening to the irritation and being mindful of the irritation and then immediately observing it and realizing, and you take that as a reminder. Because I've seen you repeatedly, have stuff come up, but then what I observe is you really do independently practice very quickly. If you spent any time with Jacqueline, you'll observe this. Correct yourself. You know, there's like a good example of that self-corrective mechanism. And I just want you to know you've been definitely an inspiration for me in that.
Thank you, Jay. And let me say that what has been really impactful for me, leads me to behave that way, to, you know, be self-correcting to the extent that I am, is, of course, Regina. She's an excellent role model in many, many, many ways. But I often hear her say something she said just kind of offhand to me one day about this judgment thing about, you know, having judgments about somebody and her learning that, well, basically, the lesson is all attack is self-attack. But her learning that it's just too painful to have judgments about people. It's just too painful to want people to do things differently. It's just too painful to need to do things my own way. It's just too painful to be right. All these things that the ego says, oh, my God, you need to do. You need to stand up for yourself. You need to do this. Or, you know, once you figure out that it's just too painful to be that way, it makes it a whole heck of a lot easier to go, oh, I listened to that for a second. Ick. Thank you. I'm done.
That leads me to my next question is, I was going to say, what's been your greatest motivator? But you touched on, I think, the one that's the most motivator for all of us, which is pain. Do you have any thoughts on, in your own path, Jacqueline, what other motivations have played a role for you in your awakening? Or is that it? I don't want to pressure you into an answer.
No, I am. I've read something in my, I'm kind of looking around the room wondering what I did with it. I've read something in my As It Is program the other day. It's a quote, a quote attributed to the Buddha in a Jed McKenna book. That talks about, through many lifetimes, through many troubles and travail, I've been lucky enough to be in this form where I can actually work on awakening, and may mountains fall on my head, you know, come what may, boy, I'm not going to squander this chance. Hmm. And, Buddha said it a lot better, but that's the sentiment. And I think that goes hand in hand with what we were talking about a minute ago. You know, look, you could be right if you want, but what are you giving up for it? It's kind of like Michael Singer's chapter on unconditional happiness. The way that read to me is, what are you willing to trade your happiness for? you know, what am I going to trade my enlightenment for? So that I can be right, so that I can look good, you know, so that other people think I'm smart. I'm going to trade enlightenment for that. Not in this lifetime. Or not for long, because frankly, a lot of that's habitual, you know, wanting to be right for me is habitual. Mm. So as soon as I see it, I realize the bargain with the devil that I've made, right? The transaction, the trade I'm making, and give it up. But, you know, again, some of it's habitual. And then that sort of thing seems to have an energy of its own, too. Once you've latched onto that, I'm the right one in this situation. It's really hard to pry those fingers off, you know. So it does take practice, but when you talk about mindfulness, it's less, you know, it might be seen as vigilance. Vigilance or mindfulness seems to make it seem like, there's a thought. Okay, that thought's okay. Oh, that one's not okay. You know, like you're all the time sorting thoughts. And really, it's just a remembrance, a real remembrance of what I want and how badly I want it.
You know, and what I hear in that is this carpe diem, this incredible gratitude that I think we all feel this to some degree, but maybe you to more of a degree, because this is your job. You get paid to do this, right? This motivation sees the day, how rare, how amazing it is that we're in a position where we can be interested and open to this and want this. You know, you describe the habitual to be right, and it's being trumped by your seize the day, gratitude-driven motivation. Would you say that's about accurate?
Yeah, it's being trumped by that. Yeah, what do I want more?
But you're not directly offering support for Trump in saying that.
No. But so mom and dad were right. Would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? I mean, really, it's that simple, right? Yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to address the what you said about the work thing. You know, it's interesting because I am utterly grateful that I am able to have work and practice combined, that I'm able to do. Yeah. You know, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm watching videos and they pay me for it. Right. Yay. That's great. But it's kind of a catch 22 as well. What I find is that I can become confused, and so I'm doing the work, which is not exactly the same as doing the practices, right? Often they're the same thing. But ego, thinking mind, the confused mind would distort it and say, well, you know, gosh, you spent all day on God. No, not really. I spent all day on, you know, I reconciled the checking account and then I worked a little while on the website or, you know, whatever the tasks are. Whereas, you know, I meditated for 20 minutes and started opening my eyes at 22 minutes, you know. So it would be easy to become confused about, you know, work is work. So it'd be easy to become confused that doing that work, you know, gets me some kind of gold star in heaven or something, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, because you're talking about the task that's at hand, and then you're talking about your consciousness performing that task. So you're saying maybe you could be doing the checkbook, but have an enlightened experience, but perhaps be distracted during your meditation. So it almost as if I'm hearing you correctly, it doesn't matter the task you're working on. It's your state of mind. Would you say that's what you said?
I'd say that's true. Yeah. 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 For all of us in that sense, you know, what I do is not any different than what anybody else does for their employment.
You know, I was part of a spiritual community a long time ago in an ashram, and people would brag about how much they meditate and how many japa repetitions they completed and all this stuff. That's kind of reminds me of the Chogyam Trungpa spiritual materialism, right? That's a great lesson for us. You mentioned your mother as a lesson you learned from her, and I was going to ask you what were some of the greatest lessons you've learned from your family? I am aware that your father was a pastor, minister, and would you share maybe some of that with us?
Well, I don't, we'll see if a lesson, specific lesson comes up. But really it's a posture towards life. My folks, both mom and dad, but dad in particular, were always looking at, the greater mystery of life, if you will. And, you know, exploring different teachings and, you know, it was a constant topic of conversation. And the bookshelves were all full of spiritual books, Dead Sea Scrolls, I remember, and Edgar Cayce and Ruth Montgomery. And I mean, I could go on and on and on. I mean, Emmett Fox, they were all there growing up. This is the environment that I grew up in. So that was certainly the greatest gift that was given to me and to all of my sisters, was to be able to grow up in an environment where not just God, but the discovery of the truth was central to, it was a central posture of life. It was like, yeah, you know, you go to work, you do the things that you do, but here's what's really important. You know, here's what we really want to do, how we really want to spend our time is pondering truth.
You know, so it's pursuing truth for truth's sake, it sounds like, rather than, I mean, in a way, I hear in what you just shared, almost a very similar sort of underpinning to what you shared just before that, which was about the consciousness with which you have through which what you do, you know, as maybe that came from your parents as the posture, you know, what's in your heart. You know, a lot of times we're taught to, be successful, do, you know, like in a very outward way, you know, and I had a mother who had all the Ruth Montgomery and Edgar Cayce books, certainly not a father that was interested. I had half of what you had in terms of upbringing. But I got the same, you know, love for truth. So the posture that I would say is a great lesson. That's a huge lesson, you know, the posture with which you approach life and the love for truth. And you know, we all want to be like our parents. So at least most people do. And, it sounds like that rubbed off on you.
I mean, it's funny. You say we all want to be like our parents. That's true, but I also wanted to be right, you know. So I had this thing, particularly with my father, he'd go, well, this passage means this. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. You know? And so we had a little bit of a headbutting thing. In fact, there's a movie about, a radio announcer, a guy that does voiceovers, and his daughter also does voiceovers. It's called In a World. And they have the same kind of struggle. You know, it's like, Dad, I want to be just like you. And please, will you pay attention, Dad? Can you see what I'm doing, Dad? And Dad just doesn't look. And I felt that, I guess, so much that I sent that movie to my dad and his wife, Susie, to watch, and I'm like, you've got to see this movie. And they're like, oh yeah, that was a fun movie. You missed it.
You missed it. Our parents, we can't really teach them a darn thing, can
no.
we?
So
On the subject of relationships, I'm going to hit you with this one here, Jacqueline. From all your relationship experience, we've only got 40 minutes left. From all of your relationships, which pale in comparison, my relationships pale in comparison to your vast experience, but I do have some, but I want to hear and ask you this very direct question, which is from maybe some that stick out more than others, whatever, but can you distill it? And I know you're unprepared to answer this, and I'm sorry if I'm putting
it's
you on the spot here.
It's all good.
But really, just shooting from the hip, what would you say, and this is towards awakening, right? What what you learned, what you gained, what were some of the big, maybe there were several you want to highlight. Let's just take all of that and ball it up somehow and share with us what you feel you've really learned, maybe a before and after, some major points along the way. What have you gained from that? What have you realized from that?
Well, of course, those of you who don't know, I'm sure everybody knows, but Jay keeps talking about my vast experience. I've been married 5 times. So let's just get that on the table. my vast experience. Let me say that probably the most impactful, and I assume you meant romantic relationships, did you not?
I kind of did, yeah.
probably the most impactful was my son's father, which was, by the way, my second marriage. I got married right out of high school, but you don't need to hear all that. But my son's father committed suicide, as you probably know, in 1986, and that really it really shook me up, made me recreate an identity from the bottom up, but what really struck me at the time was the need to express love. I had put on his spray, "You are loved," because I felt like that he was not aware of that. For me, that was a big takeaway. Don't miss an opportunity. Again, don't miss an opportunity to, let somebody know, you love them. I mean, again, it's like, there's just, life is so involved that we forget to express these things.
It's a phrase, everybody's speak as if everybody's having a bad day, comes to mind.
Yeah. It's like Dawn was talking about a while ago with her nephew feeling such empathy for her son that, you know, he had tears in his eyes. I mean, life is not structured for us to do that. I'm not at all surprised that a young kid, you know, went right there. The rest of us have that, you know, society seems to take that right out of us. So it's like, really, that's, although my sister Connie here would probably tell you I've always been the wild child, that probably explains a lot of that gusto that we talked about, that carpe diem sense that we talked about. Yeah. This is it. It's like the famous phrase says, this is life is not a dress rehearsal. So if you're going to do it, do it. If you love somebody, tell them. So for me, that was probably the biggest lesson. Let's see, I don't know. I lose count myself of the husbands, but I will say as far as another big lesson, really, I spoke to my ex-husband, Matt, just the other day, and I was reminded again of at the same time where there's that gusto and, you know, go for it, there is a need for structure and stability and commitment. Again, being there for people just in that way as well. I was just, as I spoke to him the other day, I was admiring all of those qualities in him.
It's like the, I've been a little more reserved in relationships. I've had a 3-year and another 4-year relationship. That's the extent of my long-term relationships. But, I see such a willingness to enter into relationship in you and to engage and to embrace and to walk into life. Would you feel you've always been had that urge to want to enter into and engage and embrace and participate in life? And would you say you also gained that from your family, or do you feel like you had that maybe already?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably just the personality. You know, I was crippled for a very long time by I am bad thought, unworthiness. Again, I think it's probably just personality that lay somewhat. I was a wild child, but as I became an adult, you know, I would have called myself an introvert, but I think that whole thing with Josh's dad was propelled me to go on and.
Thank you for sharing that, and I definitely received the message of don't waste any time to tell people you love them. And what a simple lesson that is, mm-hmm. to remember to tell people you love them. Why be upset with someone when it's just a reflection of something that's untrue? You know, life is precious, so precious. You know, you've been a real inspiration to a lot of us to be authentic and genuine, share from the real heart, cut to the chase, no BS. Would you say that's also just part of the personality, or would you say that has come after revelations or after your rebuilding process, or maybe along the way on the spiritual path? Any of the above?
All of the above. I think that's what we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes, truly, is the different things that have propelled me to be that way. All of them.
And maybe you saw such value in being like that. Was there ever a point where you realized or looked at people that you thought were fake and said, I don't want to be like that? Or maybe getting what you want in life, right? In general, you got to be direct and go for it, obviously, in terms of a human perspective. And in the spiritual world, we have to be willing to put ourselves into facing our dark side too, which you're also an inspiration for.
I think Jay, that it really at least at this point, that being real upfront, comes naturally. I know in business, we'd be at these term meetings of the judges, and I know how, you know, you had a relationship with that one, you have one with that one, you have one with that one, you know how they all feel, and then you get together in a meeting and nobody would say what they were thinking. And, you know, I wanted to get up on the table and go, what's wrong with you, people? Just say what you're thinking.
Why didn't you do that?
Well, you know, and their comment about me was, Jacqueline, you have no filter. So
it's good. Just,
yeah. But enough about me. Let's talk about something else.
All right. Sounds good. Enough about you. Okay. This is kind of... also, I this question is actually a silly question. I was going to ask you, when did you feel first inclined on the spiritual path? But you already answered that because your whole upbringing was, you know.
Yeah, I can say, though, that there were certainly, you know, that there were the party years. There were the studious years, you know, wore my hair in a ponytail and big glasses and, you know, went to
Harvard. Oh, I want to see a photo.
Oh, no. Awful. <It's>
like, I want to see it.
Who are you trying to be? certainly it's in my blood genetically, I guess, you know, that was all, you know, I remember laying in bed as a child and, I don't know, I just felt better when I reached up, I would just reach up and kind of meditate. I don't know. It's a strange thing. There was always this, yearning for connection with the universe larger than me.
I can definitely identify with that too, that urge that I can't quite describe or didn't really fit in, or something's off about everything I see, or just some deep thing I can't quite put my finger on that has driven me my whole life as well. I share that, I think, with probably everyone here. You've talked a few times about mystical experiences you've had, and we obviously know that mystical experiences are signposts for us. They're not there to make us either special or put a stop to our journey to think, well, now we're awakened because we had this mystical experience. Those are pitfalls, right? But I think it's also inspirational to hear about people's really amazing mystical experiences, knowing it's an inspiration. It's not to make them special or to, for yourself, stop in any way on the path. And I do want to ask you, would you share some of your most profound mystical experiences and how it moved you, if you feel to share those?
Sure. It's funny. There's a big one that I'll talk about in a minute, bigger than this one. But I will say that the one that comes to mind is not that one. The one that comes to mind is, Dad was a minister at some point at Unity of Louisville, and folks there were talking about meditating. And, I had heard of it. This was before the internet. I didn't really know what meditation was, didn't know how to find out what meditation was. And I felt particularly close to Jesus and prayed to Jesus to teach me to meditate. And Jesus taught me to meditate. I had heard the word mantra. I didn't know what a mantra was. Figured I needed one. So the mantra that I was given was Jesus Christ. Say Jesus on the in-breath and Christ on the out-breath. It was very relaxing. And I remember the first time that I was actually meditating in the bathtub with my head under the water.
For not more than 4 minutes.
Okay. my mouth and nose were above the water.
Oh, good. Okay.
more than 4 minutes explains everything, doesn't it, Jay? I'm meditating. Yes, I'm meditating under the water like this, and it just did itself.
That's cool.
I could see the thoughts. I could tell you even I was having a thought about, like, I don't know, Dad was trying to explain something. So I don't know, right? But I could see the thoughts, just like A Course in Miracles talks about them. I could see them like going by above, but that is so not where I was. Couldn't care less about those thoughts. And yet, it was like there were two tracks playing.
How do you mind if I ask your, never ask a woman her age, right? Do you know how long, how old were you when this happened?
Like 21, maybe.
Okay.
Cool. And then later the whole family decided to go for somebody put up an advertisement. I think when my sister Debbie was going to UofL and University of Louisville, and she saw it on the bulletin board. Anyway, they were going to teach us all how to meditate. So between these two periods, I was meditating for hours a day. There wasn't much else to do. I was, barefoot, pregnant. I think I had Josh when I was 21. So it was all around that same time. Husband worked all day, living in a little trailer. And I had been meditating for hours and hours. But wow. So we went, and so a day. And so we went to this fellow's apartment who had been to India and knew all the, Indian words. And so, but the first time we met at the university. And so we're all sitting around in a group. And the minute we closed our eyes to meditate, my chair basically dissolved. The legs on the chair went roar. And I got to tell you, it really scared me. It really scared me. But, you know, as far as...
Like, did you feel you were floating or what?
It just felt like everything was melting. No, it felt like the chair was giving way, and it really freaked me out. So, you know, I cut that off pretty quick. But it was you know, as far as mystical experiences go, that's the one that came to mind when you asked. So,
do you have any of these mystical experiences that come back to you? Do you use them to motivate you? I do quite a bit. It may be at times where I'm getting back into the mind, and I recall these experiences, and it helps me to come back to. Do you use them like that at all? Or
I do not. I think that's really interesting, but I do not. I have not.
Okay.
Those anyway. So do you want me to tell you about the big one?
Yeah, let's move into that.
Okay. You know what? I need to spend more time in water. This one was in water as well.
Yeah. Well, you're a water girl. You
I
told
am a water
me that.
Girl. Yes. I do love the water. In this one, I was floating around in the swimming pool, and I think I was reading Eckhart Tolle. I was reading somebody. Could have been Emmett Fox, I guess. But anyway, kind of put the book down on my chest that I've been reading and was just contemplating that. And got this really clear, it wasn't a voice, just this really clear, well, and I was in a nature all around, trees surrounded, just a beautiful environment. And I got this really clear message, I'll call it, that was like, everything is one. Yeah. Not those words. There were no words. And I'm like, all right, cool. And then it's like, let me see. You think after all these years, and this has been years ago, that I could describe it, but it's really difficult to describe, because then it just like, it got exponentially bigger, this understanding of the oneness of everything. Oops, I lost my. And it was like, you know, boom, no, everything is one. Oh, I see. And then again, boom. Oh, well, and then boom. And just, it just got huge. So then I determined, okay, I mean, there wasn't even an act to determine it, but this body wanted to take itself to another location out of the water and up a bunch of stairs. I had a hard time figuring out how to make the body move. It's like,
but you have to, like, you were learning it all over again.
Yeah. It's like, now what do we, you know, we want to be somewhere else. How do we do this? Oh, that's right. We move this leg, you know, so it got over to the side of the pool and then up all these stairs this way. And just, it was really interesting. Just not to be familiar with how to operate the body. And so then I'm like made my way all the way upstairs. I'm looking at all the nature and just, you know, grooving on it or whatever. And then I had the thought, and notice there's an I here to have the thought. And I always thought it was the nature of the thought, but really it's the nature of the I. The thought was, what will they do at work when I don't show up tomorrow? And that was the end of that mystical experience.
Oh, no, that's what brought you back. That darn work.
Well, really, it was the I thought that brought me back.
Yeah, I thought.
You know, when you started out asking me this question, I thought it was interesting because my perception of those events has changed over time. Because there was a long time when I felt like, oh man, talk about blowing your chance, blowing your shot. You know, you had this one thought that brought you, but I have come to realize that it's just not that way, that each experience like that stands on its own merits. And even to say that sounds goofy, like there's some kind of hierarchical, you know, somebody's got a chart somewhere that, you know, measures your mystical experiences. No, I'm grateful for having had the opportunity To have that understanding, it's like a glimpse behind the curtain. Really, it's just been given the glimpse, and you know, whether it lasted 5 minutes, 5 weeks, or 5 years is just so irrelevant to the glimpse itself. And there's a couple of other experiences that I have had.
Can I make a suggestion real quick?
You may.
The thought was this experience you had of expanding oneness. I think it would be really neat if you designed a meditation that you let us in that brought us through that, that maybe we could experience that or something that came from that. Just came to me to say that to you. I don't know if it came out correctly.
Well, that's really cool. It kind of, I was going to say sent a shiver down my spine, but that it didn't, it was more here, but it was like, yeah. So cool. I'll look at that. Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that I had a couple of more experiences that had felt like, oh, I get it. that came as a result of being at an enlightenment intensive, you know, where that focus is really, really there. Just the, and to say them in brief, just really feeling the flow of life and myself as the flow of life and the contrast with when, again, I wanted to think about the I, when, think about myself in terms of I and how that kind of drops the floodgates on the flood of life. And then the other experience was after.
Bless you, whoever that was. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Don.
That was just an exclamation point on your mystical experience.
That was awesome. after my dad passed and realizing that what I felt was gratitude and that gratitude that I felt, not obviously not gratitude for his death, but just gratitude, gratitude underlies everything. Absolutely. On the other side of every single experience, on the other side of every single emotion, it is, you know, it's the stuff that life is made of.
I'm just receiving that right now, what you said about gratitude underlying everything. And I feel that from you, Jacqueline. I asked you these things because a lot of times I do get mileage out of my mystical experiences. Present day, maybe it's a little different than your path.
No, but. I would say that those last two that we talked about with that, just that flow and that eye dropping the floodgates and the gratitude. No, I think that those do in fact come back and inform, you know, what's going on for me now.
I'm running out of questions. so you had a, you've moved to Lavita recently, or not to Lavita? I'm sorry.
I'm not quite there yet.
I'm shifting time frame. Sorry.
you moved to Lavita.
I moved to Lavita recently. You've moved across the country for spirit via our beloved Regina, who doesn't want to be a guru, who's not a guru. But I'm saying it was for spirit. just lots of questions related to that. Did you in your human self have some problems with that when it first came to you to do that? Cause I did, it took me a solid year before I actually acted on that. what went through you and what was your process with making a big move in your life? That's not career related. It's purely for spirit. Like you're uprooting, you're dealing financial, personal, like everything in a human life is brought up to question and changed in some way for spirit, which is kind of what you did.
Well, no, yeah, but that wasn't what you did. That wasn't when I moved to Colorado. I did that in 2010 when I quit my job for life, gave up my full salary, lifetime retirement, and my red convertible, which I still miss.
Well, maybe that's then what I want to ask you about, is that sort of change of life moment where...
Yeah, and that was a real change when I had no idea what I was going to do, how I was going to put food on the table, what life was going to look like. I did that back in 2010. It was so clear. And, you know, it's funny because before that, and I was miserable before that, you know, I had all the bells, whistles, you know, everything, prestige, home, car, you know, whatever, money. Before that, before I heard very decisively that I was to leave that, whatever, life, I kept hearing the word service. I mean, I'm just going about my business. I'm not doing Course in Miracles. I'm not, you know, I have off and on for 30 years. You know, I'm just, you know, I'm partying. I'm having a good time. I'm doing what I'm doing. And this word keeps coming to my head, service. What? Service. I mean, just at random times, have no idea what it means or why it's coming in my head. You know, I'm even going, do you mean like at a soup kitchen? What do you mean service?
So you're saying a word came in your head. Was it a feeling with the word or was it just a word?
Just the word. I mean, and I had really had no idea what it meant or why it was coming in my head.
Was it a sound? Did it say service or was it like a printed just like, English word?
No, it was like, I don't know. I think it was spoken. I don't know. Maybe it was just knowing Jay. I can't say. But as I tell it, I think it was just like service. What?
Just the thought of okay, like, you're being told service in your ear, right? Okay.
And then it became really clear that I was to leave, and that was you know, it was difficult, but it was just, it was just so clear to me that there was. Well, you know, and then what I did was I took the big steps. I went to my campaign committee and said, hey, guess what? I'm leaving.
I would like to cut in and say that yes, most people don't realize, but Jacqueline and I lived in the same town of Louisville from 1998 to 2001. And every
didn't
time
even know
I
it.
Didn't even know it. And I was directing the School of Metaphysics there doing my little spiritual thing. And I would see these orange and black signs in the lawn everywhere, vote for Judge Eckert. So
they were the best signs. I won the best campaign sign of my colleagues. Well,
those are Halloween colors, right?
Yeah, well, you can't miss them. You can't miss them.
But anyway, I still remember
need
to this
make
day.
Visible signs. Yeah.
So I knew of Jacqueline, but I never actually met her. Well, given her job at the time, I'm glad that
it's a good thing that you didn't say. I was a hard ass. I really was. but yeah, that was a difficult transition to make. But again, I think that, that the transition is made easier, you know, by taking bold steps, by saying to the campaign committee, I'm not going to run next time, by when your, colleagues call in or, and the lawyers call and say, hey, I'd like to run for your seat. Are you sure you're not running? By saying, no, I'm not running. You know, by making the commitment. And gosh, if that isn't true across the board for spirituality, I mean, you take the big, bold steps and you make the commitment. You know, you don't have, as Hoffmeister used to say, you don't have plan B, right? You just follow your heart and you make the commitment.
Would you say that the primary love for truth's sake, and that's what's really important in this career stuff is what you're doing on the outside was implanted in you as just a child, and that you did go for the worldly path, but then ultimately that inner, which, you know, you incarnate into a family with two very spiritual parents and a spiritual, you know, like, do you think that just took over, like your programming kicked in like a script at some point, that service? Or
I don't know that it's, you know, how much is nurture and how much is nature. I think it's all in our nature. Yeah, I think it's in all our nature. I think it's in all our nature, this call home, this yearning, this, you know, you and Connie were talking about it earlier, this yearning to be home, to belong to something that's bigger than you, to be beyond the small self. you know, again, I think the personality's kind of been that way, you know, all or nothing. So I think that that certainly helped. And, you know, it's a perfect storm, right? And parents who pointed me in the right direction. Yeah. Right, Ron says.
Yeah, it's just interesting to hear your life story in so many ways parallels mine with parents that were spiritual in all that way, even more so than mine. And I rarely meet people that have spiritual parents that, you know, it's a rare thing that were dedicated to it like that. So you talk about going all in. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's the
commitment. Tell me about going all in.
Sure. It's the commitment to do whatever I'm asked to do. Not by Regina, you know, not by Jay. not by the organization. It's whatever I'm asked to do. When guidance comes, is to fully follow it. And not only just to fully follow guidance, but to be willing to hear that guidance, even if it's absolutely against what I want to do. I mean, and that's the only way you can hear guidance anyway.
Do you allow yourself the reaction to the guidance as well?
Ask me.
Because sometimes do you allow yourself to hear the reaction to the guidance? Like sometimes I'll hear guidance, I'm like, oh, come on. Like I'll have a reaction to it like that. A human mind, like here's the guidance and then the human mind reacts to it.
Yeah. Earlier I said, you know, I picture myself being dragged, kicking, and screaming. I mean, because, you know, I asked Regina, she'll go, well, I think it's this. And I'll go, it is not. And I'll holler that for a week. And then I'll go, you know, it was that. So, I allow myself the human reaction. You bet I do.
That was a dumb question, of course. You'll hear someone. No. So currently, would you say, like, when you talk about teachings, there's the inner teacher, which of course Regina's primary message is that we all can listen to the inner teacher, and any true master always teaches that it's not about me, it's about you listening to the inner teacher. I've always had that philosophy, and I'm grateful to have found Regina who definitely teaches that philosophy. I don't even know if it's a philosophy, it's more just like truth. And then there's the outer teachings, the books we read, inspiration we get from hearing other teachers. What would you say where you're at, or maybe where you've been and where you're at now with the mix of what you receive inspiration from the outer teachings, and how's that moved? Do you receive purely from the inner teachings now? Would you say it's a mix of both? Like, tell us your journey with that.
Well,
the outer versus inner teachings.
I would say it's a mix of both, but I would say that the most fundamental teachings, the teachings that reach me fundamentally, are the teachings that come from inner wisdom. You know, I think that we're most of us are at a point where we have the fundamentals down, you know, quit grasping, quit trying to build a self. I mean, you know, question your thoughts, you know, there's a slew of teachings that we have down. So it's not, more information is not what's needed at this point for probably most of us. What I think we do, and certainly we teach folks who haven't heard these things before. We teach them these things, I think, in the organization and Awakening Together. But I think what we really do is strengthen our understanding of those teachings, and not on an intellectual basis. I mean, it's an experiential thing. Just like we started out talking about, you know, when something comes up, you don't revert to your habitual ways of being. You revert to the teachings, and you apply the teachings. And so it's the application of the teachings that seems critical now. And, you know, as A Course in Miracles would say, you know, make no exceptions.
And fortunately, we have Shauna's notes to borrow from.
Right. Our willingness to not make any exceptions is really where the rubber meets the road. because otherwise we're, for me, otherwise I'm playing at spirituality. I'm playing at being spiritual. I'm adopting some kind of spiritual persona. But I have to be willing to put these teachings into place when I don't want to, when I don't want to look at myself, when I want to blame you, metaphorically, you or Shauna or Dawn or Cheryl or Regina, right, or Tom. I have to be willing to put the teachings into practice always, always. And that's where the progress is made for me.
Now, how do you see your comment you made a little bit ago? You described yourself as being all in. And how do you see that as related to the comment you just made now, which is make no exceptions? How do you see those as connected?
Thing, right? It's those. Really,
I don't know. You tell me.
Okay. Well, no, it really is the same thing. And I think it also relates back to your comment about, you know, do you allow yourself the human reaction? Yeah. You know, it's as soon as the remembrance comes, you know, that it's only myself I attack. Right, that I'm the author of my own suffering. It's as soon as the remembrance comes that you put the practice into practice. I can't believe so and so said that. Shoot, now I have to journal about it. I mean, that's generally how it's
right. You got to, darn it, more fodder for root cause and inquiry. Darn it, anyway.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, I have this image. Go ahead.
No, I wanted to say I really do appreciate the question about is it inner teachings or outer? And I think we all have that. Well, I know we do have that font of inspiration and wisdom within us. And I think it's shocking how much I and perhaps many of you how often we fail to draw on the riches that we can find there if only we just do it.
Would you repeat that, please?
You know, sometimes I'm reluctant to sit down with inner wisdom and go, I can't believe so-and-so said that. I'm reluctant to sit down with inner wisdom, right? And it's like, oh, my God, are you kidding? There's a gold mine there. You know, you walk around all day, every day going, you know, I want to wake up. I want to wake up. Well, wake up. Pick up the pen, right, with inner wisdom. and I think, I don't think this is anything unique to me or you or Regina or anybody else. That font of wisdom who will tell you exactly what you need to do, when you need to do it, is right there. I mean, it's in this ink pen, right? All I got to do is put this ink pen to paper and then practice what I'm told. And, you know,
And you're not talking about that specific ink pen. It could be
any ink pen, right? Yes. Yeah. It's really in my willingness to do as I'm told. And of course, what I'm told is to pick up the ink pen. And then I'm told what else I need to know. And I'm told how to put that into practice. And we all admire and revere Regina and the spiritual awakening that Regina has experienced is exactly from that. She's told what to do, and she does it. She's told to do the lesson on the hour, every hour, and she does it. And
I'm told to interview Jacqueline, and I do it.
That's right. Yeah. But what I've seen most of us do, and certainly what I've seen in myself, is on the hour, are you sure? Could it be an hour and 15? You know, it's like, why are you dragging your feet? You know, so it's just, but it's keeping the eye on the prize and understanding that if this is something that you want, you have to go get it.
Wow. What a great place to wrap up the interview. You have to go get it. You got to go all in. You got to take those chips and push them in. You got to, no delay. From the moment the reminder comes, we have to practice it. That is my takeaway from this interview with Jacqueline. Jacqueline Eckert, it's been a fun and an honor interviewing you. Even though I've known you like 9 years, I'm acting like I don't know you.
It's been my pleasure, Jay. It's really, really a wonderful time. I really appreciate you inviting me to do this. And I'm honored, and I'm honored every day to be with each and every one of you. Thank you.
Amen. Thank you all for being here. Good night.